Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast about politics. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hello.
Steve, what have plastic glasses, motorcycle helmets, record keeping, and which magazine got in common?
I think I'm going to have to start kind of being the main host of these shows just so I can avoid doing these quizzes in future. I have no idea.
They've all helped to reduce crime.
Whoa, hold on. Give me that list again.
Plastic glasses, motorcycle helmets, record keeping, and which magazine?
Okay, so plastic glasses, you know, people being hit with glasses and things in pubs or something like that, I can see. Record keeping?
Yep. Do you remember a few years ago, the big thing was metal theft?
Mm.
And to try and address that, the UK government tried to do a couple of things. One of the things it did was say that rather than pay for scrap metal cash in hand, you have to pay for it electronically.
Okay.
Now, that meant that there was
a record of who's received it, because it's going into your bank account, at which point, if things are being stolen or whatever, you can actually go, right, who are these people?
Exactly.
Okay.
You also had to keep a record of who you bought your metal from. And so you had to give a name, you had to give identification.
Ah, so it was basically a trail of authenticity.
Exactly. This was supported by a lot of the bigger, more respectable scrap metal dealers as well, because obviously this kind of thing, it pulls out the criminals and the cowboys, but it means you look more respectable. It means you kind of get away from that Steptoe and Son rag and bone man image. But since then, metal theft has declined. Now, which magazine? In the 1980s, car theft was a big problem in the UK, and often that's because cars were very easy to get into. So
okay.
A famous case was the Ford Cortina, and apparently a set of Ford Cortina keys would get you into every single Ford Cortina in the UK. That's how bad the security was. But the UK government were struggling to get car manufacturers on side to improve car security. And if you think about it, a car company doesn't really have an incentive to improve car security.
Because if the car gets nicked, they have to buy a new car.
Exactly. So in 1991, the UK government published a car theft index, and that rated cars on how regularly they were stolen. Which magazine took this index and they publicised it and they kept publishing it. Now, obviously, this then gives an incentive, or I suppose we'd probably call it a nudge if we were behavioural economists, to car companies to increase the security in their cars. So stopping the problem of car theft is, some criminologists have argued, it's a big reason for the decline of crime that we've seen in Britain over 20, 30 years. Stolen cars are often used for other things as well. So you might use them for burglaries, for instance. You might use them for gang shootings. Joyriding, apparently, is a bit like a gateway drug. Often if you start joyriding,
you'll graduate to burglary or something else.
Yeah. In 1997, 13% of violence between strangers, glass bottles were used, or glass was used.
Mm-hmm.
And since plastic glasses were introduced, that's now down to 4%. Now, motorcycle helmets, in the 1970s and 1980s, rather than it being car theft that was the problem, motorcycles being stolen was the problem. In Holland and in Germany and in Great Britain, after motorcycle helmets were made compulsory, that meant that motorcycles were much less likely to be stolen. And the reason is, it's much easier to be caught, and it's much easier for the police to see if you've got a stolen motorbike if you're not wearing a motorcycle helmet. Because if you're not wearing a motorcycle helmet, the police are more likely to pull you over, get your license and registration, at which point they realise you've stolen that motorcycle.
Okay.
Hopefully this quiz is a little bit less esoteric than some of the ones I subject you to with usually on the podcast.
Yeah.
Now, this season of Not Enough Champagne is all about personal responsibility. And there's probably no better case of personal responsibility than crime. Crime should not happen, and that criminals should be punished for the crime that they commit. And I think that's an assumption we can make on the podcast. I think where we're wrong is on the assumptions we make about crime.
Okay, like what?
In these cases, no change was made to sentences.
Yep.
So there was no attempt to deter these crimes by passing harsher sentences. There was also no attempt to address what we might call the root causes of crime, this idea that it's poverty that leads to crime. You could argue that one of the reasons crime has declined over the past 50 years is maybe because living standards are getting better. But these reforms all happened over a short period of time. There's no big change in material circumstances which led to this. All these are little specific reforms that work. All the examples that we've talked about, they're from a book by Tom Gash called Criminal. And we're going to talk a little bit more about it after this. Thomas Gash argues that there are two main narratives of crime, and we've alluded to them already in this podcast. So one, he calls heroes and villains. And this is the idea that criminals are malevolent and they will stop at nothing to commit crime. And the police are wonderful, righteous and solve crime. You can see this, if you're looking at fiction, this is like the Inspector Morse view or the Sherlock Holmes view of the world. Criminals should be punished with harsh sentences. Harsh sentences deter criminals from committing crimes. We need to have more bobbies on the beat because that means that crimes can be solved.
Mm-hmm.
The other narrative is victims and survivors, and this is the view that the root causes of crime are often poverty and neglect,
yeah,
and inequality. So Robin Hood may be your classic fictional example of this. Another fictional example that Gash mentions is The Wire, and I think that's certainly probably among our generation and our social group of lefty pseudo-intellectuals, and I count us both as this. I imagine The Wire is probably quite an important framing device in how a lot of us view criminals.
It's all about poverty and lack of opportunity for to actually get by in life. Yeah. Not about, it's never their fault. It's always,
you're born into it, and it's those structures you're in, and there's not much you can do to escape it. And this idea that it's cyclical as well.
Yeah, structures are defining everything. No, you have no agency type of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. We saw both these views at play when we talked about the 2011 riots.
Yeah.
Cameron was very much heroes and villains view, you know, these people who were committing crimes were morally bankrupt. It was a sign of broken Britain. And those incidents were punished with very harsh sentences.
And on the other side of that, you'd got Ken Livingstone making the case that it was all down to the circumstances of the people who found themselves in, and that it was all the Tories' fault for cutting various programmes which would have helped them get out of poverty and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Tom Gash is a senior fellow of the Institute of Government.
Does he say it's all bullshit?
He says both those are wrong. Most crime is opportunistic. It happens because it's easy to commit. And, I mean, you can see this in, say, the metal theft, for instance. It wasn't making metal harder to steal. What it was making it harder to profit from it. Or, for instance, a lot of crime happens on a Friday on payday. That happens because people go to the pub, they drink. If you've got lots of strangers in the pub who are quite drunk, they might get quite rowdy. You have an argument, you bump into someone accidentally, you use whatever weapons to hand.
And it happens to be a glass, so you glass them and suddenly everyone's an A&A.
Yeah, exactly, it shatters everyone. If it's a plastic glass, it doesn't have the same effect. And Gash's book is a list of these myths about crime. So, for instance, this idea that there's a very, very small subset of criminals that are like hardened career criminals. Actually, one in four in the UK has a criminal record. Now, this might just be something simple like it might be a caution, it might just be a warning. Anyone could commit a crime at some point. It's not like, actually, probably most of us have committed some form of crime, whether it's jaywalking,
running a light,
any of those kind of things. If you look at America, for instance, half of murders happen as a result of an argument.
Yep.
It's not like Inspector Morse, where there's this big dastardly plan to kill the professor of the college in some sort of locked room scenario.
Yeah, in actuality, the professor at the college just got drunk down the local too much and bumped into somebody and he got whacked around the head with a baseball bat.
And a quarter of them happen in other crimes where they panic. So, for instance, you're robbing a shop, you get disturbed.
You shoot them.
Yeah. Realising it's about self-control is very, very important. Now, the examples we're talking about is nursery children. If anything, the most criminal members of our society are probably our nursery school children. 45% of two-year-old boys are frequently involved in biting,
yeah,
kicking, fighting other people. But we don't classify that as crime. We talk about that as being the terrible twos.
Yeah.
It starts to become criminal behaviour in this country at the age of 10. Crime is a young person's game. In the media, and a lot of the problem, I think, is the stereotypes that the media talk about. The media have this stereotype of a hardened career criminal. You know, people like Roy LaMotta, people like John Dillinger.
Yeah.
Like the Hatton Garden robbers, for instance, they're all kind of elderly men who we think are hardened career criminals. Actually, most crime is committed by the young. There are more 12-year-olds who are cautioned for offences every year than there are 45-year-olds in terms of men. So what happens is you have lots of offending takes place in the early teenage years, maybe even early 20s, and then it dies off. That might be because those people have found a purpose in life. Either maybe they've grown out of it, or they've got a partner, they've got their own, they've got children of their own now, they want to grow up and set a better example.
Mm-hmm. I know, in my head, all I can kind of focus on here is you said that crime is opportunistic, and that, you know, crime is committed by the young, or young men, primarily. So I'm sat here kind of going, how do you marry those two things together to prevent crime actually from occurring? Because, you know, let's take potentially controversial crime here, rape and sexual assault. These are things which, you know, sadly happen. 90% of the people who do it commit it are men. And it's almost always against women. From a opportunistic or stopping the opportunity for it to happen, the solution would be women don't go out on their own at all, which is obviously not a feasible thing from engaging either.
You're looking at it a bit narrowly. So reducing opportunities for that means better street lighting. It means more public transport home. If you had more night buses, for instance,
no one has to walk.
No one has to walk home. If it's better lit, you've got less places of prowlers to be around. So it's little things like that.
Okay, so it's all about almost the peripheral aspects of it, rather of the crime that cause the criminal or the perpetrator to not want to be there in those sorts of circumstances, where they are much more likely to be, yes, opportunistic, but also more likely to be planned.
Most criminals commit crimes young, and then it's a young person's game. You don't really do it in your 30s, 40s, 50s.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, there's more reoffending happens in 40 or 50 year olds now than it used to be two or three decades ago.
Yeah.
Now, a theory among criminologists is that those people were criminals as young men in the 80s, when committing crimes was easier,
yeah,
as we've kind of hinted at. So actually, it's kind of easy to fit in those bad habits. But most crimes opportunistic. Most people become less criminal as they get older. What you have to then focus on is those people who are persistent reoffenders. So if we're going to take your sexual assault crimes, for instance, you look at your predators,
yeah,
you're looking at your serial offenders, and how do you engage them? How do you rehabilitate those kind of people? What instead we do, and
is we lock everybody up in prison with each other.
Yeah, well, exactly. And what we do, which is particularly stupid, and Britain's followed the American line in this, and is one of the reasons why our prison system is so overcrowded, is we have a kind of two or three strikes and you're out. In Britain, for instance, it's a certain amount of sentence if you have a second offence for possessing a knife, for instance. If you are of the view that most people commit crimes when you're young, particularly young men, and then you stop as you get older, what we're doing is we're putting young men in prison at precisely the age when they would probably, in all likelihood, stop reoffending and stop committing crimes and move on to the straight and narrow. But we don't give them a chance to do that. Instead, what we do is we bung them in prison for 10 years, for instance. What Durham has started doing, and their police commissioner started doing this apparently, is...
Wait, whoa. The police commissioners are doing something useful?
I know.
I'm in shock.
So what they've started doing is, if you commit certain offences, rather than go to prison straight away, you get a chance to get help, whatever it is. So it might be training for a job, it might be training for, yeah, qualifications. If you're on drink or drugs, they might get you on a treatment program.
Yeah.
If you stop doing that training, then you would get tried and sentenced for the offence you already committed. Prevention rather than harsh sentences, which, and let's face it, it's not working at the moment. 46% of prisoners reoffend a year after they are released. Now, that's because they're not getting the practical support they need to reoffend. You know, in our prison population, the amount of people who've never had a job is overrepresented. The amount of people who have depression is overrepresented. The amount of people who have no qualifications is overrepresented in our prison population compared to the ordinary population. But our prisons at the moment, their budgets are being cut, they're overstretched, the number of wardens is being cut. There's no way of providing any practical support yet. Instead, we're locking them in prison for 10 or 15 years and saying that means we're tough on crime. It doesn't. It means we're being stupid on crime. in Birmingham. We can get our obscure Birmingham reference in for that. Winston, I think, Green. We missed it, yeah. Winston Green. So prisoners took over four wings of that prison there. And 240 prisoners of those 400 were involved. This prison's problem and this overcrowding is becoming more and more of an issue. So our prison population has doubled in 20 years. It was 40,000 in the early 90s, and yep, now it's 80,000.
Just running through my head with this is, yeah, okay, some people are definitely going to be good, just going to grow out of it. Other people are going to be the sorts of people who are more likely to reoffend. So the issue then kind of becomes, is there a way almost of identifying those people? Because otherwise you are, and now I'm not saying this program is ever worse than what we've got. I actually think it, from the sounds of things, it would improve the situation. But you are then potentially putting someone back on the street who is, yeah, in theory, they're part of this program, they're going to do all of these things, but they can do all of those things and still carry that knife. So it all becomes a bit of a, okay, so is there a way you can work out and identify those people that are more likely to recommit? And I think that's one of the situations where if you are going to go down this route, you need to try and work that out. And unfortunately, I suspect the only way you can do that is with either data generalised, which isn't what you want to go down at all, or you end up with having to look at individuals to such a degree where you're either looking at stuff that's not really relevant, or you're only able to look at them after they've done a whole load of stuff. So if they've done it two or three times, then you can go, absolutely, you're going back, you're going in, because clearly you are a person who's going to recommit. But the problem is, at that point, they've already done two or three more offences, and depending on what that is, that can be for anything. They've robbed two or three more people. To me, I think it would be very difficult, unless you have that system in place, to make this work, solely from the public kind of policy PR perspective of it, because anyone who puts this in place without a kind of a notion of this is how we identify these people is going to hit the wall of you're just letting criminals back on the street.
I think that's an interesting point. Reminds me of a couple of other things he mentions in the book on how you can tell. The reason why our criminal responsibility age is 10 is because of the killing of James Bulger in 1993.
Yeah.
The two boys involved, John Venables and Robert Thompson.
Yep.
Now, both of those were subsequently released from prison and were living under false names. Cue media outcry.
Yeah.
Robert Thompson is living under an assumed name.
Yep.
He's working, apparently, Gash interviews one of the criminologists to rehabilitation officers who were dealing with him, and apparently he's working as like a security guard, like crowd security or something.
Yeah.
And he says, I saw him randomly, I think just in passing, and he was doing fine. He's moved on with his life. He's one of these people who, horrific thing that he did at the age of 10, he's now a functioning member of society. He has a job, he has a life, he is not in a position where he's going to offend again, and has served his time, he's released. Now, John Venables, he instead, I think, was released, he was arrested, he had images of porn, I believe it was child porn, on his computer. He's been arrested for that subsequent offence.
Yeah.
So in terms of how do you know, I think you've got to, if you have the rehabilitation system set up, some, like Robert Thompson, will be
identify themselves through that system.
And in some ways you've got to suck it and see. Now I agree that leads to that massive PR problem of what happens if a guy is on parole for murder
and
does it again. But if you think about what we're doing at the moment, is we're giving people long sentences for two very trivial offences, which isn't working at the moment.
I agree. I think with trivial offences, there's and you know, non-violent offences especially, I think there's probably, and by non-violent I mean actually physically attacking people. And I know that technically the law, things like burglary can count as violent and whatnot, but I mean just like physically assaulting someone, attacking someone, all of that kind of stuff, you can probably get away with it under the justification that, you know, for the most part you can probably get these young people from stopping doing it. I think it becomes a much very, very difficult and difficult at least. It's not, as much as I'm in favour of rehabilitation and things like that, if you are dealing with a murderer, so even if it's a kid who's didn't quite understand what they were doing because one of the others was being led, as I think is the case with the Bulger killers, or whatever it is, punishment is such an integral part of the human psyche that with those sorts of people, I would expect and want them to receive a form of punishment, and simply rehabilitation would not necessarily.
But I think here you're looking at the most extreme case. I mean, obviously for murder, it's a mandatory life sentence. And yes, you might be released after parole, but that parole is going to be a very, very long time.
Yeah.
But I don't think we're talking about murder here. I think instead, I mean, say you're looking at gang members, for instance.
Yeah.
So I think when you're looking at those rehabilitation programs, I think the problem that we have is that we have a bit of a one-size-fits-all.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, there's an interview with a pastor, I believe in Los Angeles, and his thing is all about rehabilitating gangsters. Now, it ends up being stuff like they work in bakeries, they work in cafes, that kind of thing. There's a quite amusing aside where he says, we thought about maybe having plumbing, but it turns out that you can't really have them working as plumbers because people don't want to invite ex-gang members into their house to do their plumbing. So that was a sideline that didn't really work.
Odd that.
But his thing is that he will only take people who want to do it. And I think it's as part of that kind of growing up, maybe getting the responsibility of a relationship. So it could be getting the responsibility of having children and you want to be a good role model as a dad, or it might be I've got a new missus and it's either if you commit another crime, I'm gone.
So again, what I'm hearing here is we need to set all the potential criminals on match.com.
But I mean, in all seriousness, having a partner is probably part of it. It's bringing them back into society. There's a pilot program that was done in this country, which is a similar kind of thing to that Los Angeles pastor, who is saying it's kind of parole officers working closely with offenders to rehabilitate them. And at the end of their sentence, this isn't instead of going to prison, but at the end of the sentence, mm-hmm. get released. Now, Chris Grayling saw it was working and puts it out as a full scheme before the end of the pilot scheme. Now, there's a couple of problems with that. One of them is that it's more powerful if the offender themselves chooses to do it.
Yeah.
It's almost like giving up any addiction. The first step is you have to want to do it.
So it's one of those things where for people who are already in prison, you're saying you can get out early if you're agreeing to do this.
Yeah, or you can't, basically you can't force them to do it,
yeah.
I think. You've got to choose to make, you've got to make that choice to want to change. If you don't choose to make that choice, well, obviously there's not much you can do. But I think the other problem is a small pilot scheme is good. If you've got a small scheme of highly trained parole officers who are passionate about it and who are really good at it, however, if you roll it out on a national level, you've got to recruit more people. Those people might not be as good, but also they might be more cynical about it.
Yeah.
It's a bit like teachers in a school. Each school is going to be different, and each head teacher will have a different teaching philosophy. And what works in some schools might not work in other schools. I think it's probably the same with rehabilitation programs.
Mm.
And I think that gets lost when we have a one-size-fits-all. And that's why there's an IPPR report we'll link to in the show notes. What they're about is devolving the responsibility to probation services and custody for short sentences, young and women offenders, to police commissioners or to city mayors. Now, this might shock you for anyone who listened to our last series on taking back control, but that sounds like a quite attractive policy for us. We love the localism.
I think the kind of the success or failure of these sorts of schemes and of making this work all boils down to actually the engagement of the criminal or potential criminal. I mean, this is something we're going to be discussing later on in the series anyway, but it does boil down to those kind of nudges, the behavioural psychology of it all, and how you can, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, manipulate people into making the correct choices. Because as you say, if the scheme only really works if they volunteer for it, then you need to find a way that you're making basically everybody volunteer for it. Now, it could be actually that when we were talking about how do you identify people that are going to be working with it, that are going to be problematic in the future, well, it could literally just be that the way they volunteer for it, because some people will volunteer for it just to get out of it, but if a part of the scheme is still whilst you're in prison, say, and it's, I don't know what it would be like, it's your CV building aspects of it, say, depending on their behaviour in there, you're not just assessing them or moving them along the scheme, you're assessing them for, are they actually good enough to get out? Are they just taking the piss? If they aren't taking the piss, then they can move. If they are, they get kicked off the scheme and they go back in.
And that's something you can probably do on what you could call a more human thing,
yeah.
to quote Steve Hilton's book, than anything else. I think the most interesting thing about Tom Gash's book is that it's kind of made me I don't know if less ideological is a thing, but it's not about having a grand narrative and saying this is what works, we're going to do it. It's about having, I think, lots of little plans.
Yeah.
And lots of little things from lots of passionate people over the country is probably the way it's going to work. I think that's one thing we've got to do. But I think, as you hinted before, another thing I think is to change the narrative on crime a little bit, because the media reporting of crime and the sensationalism of crime really does fuel that heroes and villains thing. This idea that there's some hardened career criminals that are out to get us and that some people cannot change. Now, that's not necessarily true, and it's probably something we need to combat as well.
If we're talking narratives that need combating, you would also need to combat the other side of that, which, mm-hmm. as Gatchett apparently said, is equally false. That notion that criminals are victims of circumstance, and that is something which is very pervasive on the left, and it is the left who are more likely to implement these sorts of things, I would imagine, in general, just because the right wing of politics tends to be much more focused on that traditional law and order, crime and punishment routine. And if you can't get the left to get away from their, you know, crime as victim of circumstance narrative, then nothing will get done.
I can see the right doing it as well. I mean, Michael Gove was trying to do it before he left his post as Justice Secretary. I think the right will end up having to do it basically out of budgets, that it's going to be far too expensive to keep locking up 80, 90, 100,000 people. At the moment, some prisons are on 160% capacity. The average prison is at 111% capacity. Budgets are being cut. It is not sustainable. I mean, it's a human problem too. Britain has 117 suicides per 100,000 prisoners. The amount of suicides has doubled in about 5 years. To put that into context, so Britain's 117 per 100,000. India is 18 per 100,000. In America, it's 15 per 100,000. So it's more than 10 times that.
Wow.
But I think you're right. What we do need is that political will. Now, we did have that political will in Britain. The prison population halved between 1908 and 1938. And a lot of the reason for that is because
liberals were in charge.
One particular liberal, I won't quiz you on it because you're sick of quizzes. Winston Churchill,
yeah,
he'd been imprisoned. He argued that prison shouldn't be in place for minor offences.
Yeah, Churchill was very conservative and actually in a lot of things, but his views on crime and punishment and things like that were incredibly liberal and quite far ahead of their time, actually.
And if you're looking for a narrative of how you can bring being sensible on crime in terms of British values,
Churchill would do.
Churchill, yeah, exactly. And I think that's maybe a good note on which to end. Please check out our website, notenoughchampagne.com, for more almost interesting, almost informed analysis. If you can subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us a review, that really does help people discover the show as well. If you like this podcast, please tell whoever you can, however you can. You can find us on Twitter. I'm at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Centre Radical.
James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him at Twitter at James Cram. And our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper. You can find that at freemusicarchive.org. We'll be broadcasting again from our nuclear bunker next week. Hope you enjoyed it. Bye-bye.